Governor DeSantis proposes the state's budget and the need for more black nutritionists. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The 2021 legislative session starts in March, and there are some controversial bills that lawmakers will debate. In order to get those bills passed, though, they will need to be funded through the budget. We'll get our first look at the upcoming session. Also, nutrition is not a one-size-fits-all. It changes depending on your ethnicity and race. We're going to speak with two black women about their desire to help minority communities rethink nutrition and health. We'll also discuss how to keep our cultural traditions with a focus on health. And finally, what is one of the biggest moments in art in Miami over the past decade? Well, there's a new book out looking at the key moments in art in the last 10 years. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Small mom-and-pop shops, all the way up to major retail stores, have all been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. Local governments are seeing a squeeze on their budgets as many have been forced to furlough employees. But how about the state of Florida? How has it weathered the COVID storm? Well, according to Governor Ron DeSantis, pretty well.
The Florida Leeds fiscal year 21-22 budget continues to make important investments in our education system and the environment and puts Florida on solid financial footing with $6.6 billion in total reserves.
The governor released his planned budget for the 2021-22 fiscal year. The budget will need to be approved by the legislature, which is set to meet in March. We're joined now by Mary Ellen Claus, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Good to be here, Lewis. Thanks.
All right, let's start with this price tag, $96 billion. That's more than the legislature approved last year. And we're in a pandemic and an economic slowdown. So how's the governor justifying the cost?
Well, the governor didn't really put too much of a spotlight on this point, but the historic rise is really the result of enormous amounts of federal relief money that has flowed into the economy. The state itself has received about $4.5 billion in COVID relief money. Then we've got revenues that have been buoyed by federal stimulus checks and $17 billion in federal unemployment payments paid to jobless Floridians. So that's a lot of money really propping up where we are.
So looking at Florida's sales tax and hotel occupancy taxes, how hard were they hit and what has that done to the state's finances?
Well, it's you're right to point that out because, you know, as we all have watched, many things are just struggling, many businesses are struggling. And so the result is there's been about a $2.75 billion drop in projections in revenue collections. So that's a huge, pretty big, chasm to close. And the governor's pretty optimistic that those revenue forecasts are going to improve as the economy turns around.
I mean, he thinks they're going to improve, but again, we have a budget that we've got to vote on in a couple of months. Let's take a look at education. DeSantis wants to increase funding for K through 12 schools by nearly $300 million from last year. He's putting a focus on mental health. Now, one of the initiatives, that's one of the important initiatives for the First Lady, but didn't lawmakers say that schools should prepare for cuts?
Well, yes. And the governor himself has put aside or has ordered his agencies to hold back 6% of their total budgets. So there has, which has amounted to about $800 million. And then you've got legislators that are very concerned about whether we're going to be able to make up the difference in the education budget this year going forward. Now, the problem is that the governor's budget doesn't match in some places. A Senate committee today raised the point that there are about 88,000 students who didn't return to school this year, and the governor's budget still counts them. So, they've got some questions they need to answer. So it's very, it seems as though the governor's budget will not, we all know it's not going to be the final budget, but now they're, at least the Senate is raising questions about the reliability of some of their numbers.
Yeah. Transportation. We saw fewer cars on the road back last March and April, but I don't know if you've driven around Miami. Everything seems normal. Rush hour. It's terrible again. How much does the governor plan to invest on transportation, especially I know there's a controversy over new toll roads.
Yeah. So it looks as though there is a move, a pretty large move by people who are in like Tax Watch and some of these conservative think tanks who've urged the governor to pull back on a proposal that was going to build three new toll roads down the middle of Florida. That wasn't going to have much immediate impact to the congestion in Miami-Dade. So we weren't going to see much benefit of that. The governor has continued to keep that money in his budget. But there's now, it appears as if there are some legislators that are willing to maybe put that idea on hold and save some money, and maybe put it into places like transit or, in making it easier in places that are facing congestion.
Again, talking with Mary Ellen Kloss, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about Governor Ron DeSantis releasing his 21-22 budget this past week, and you can read more about that proposal. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, March 2nd is the start of the legislative session. DeSantis made waves when he was first elected for his pledges to the environment, requesting hundreds of millions of dollars for Everglades restoration. Do we see a similar commitment to the environment in this budget, or has that kind of waned a little bit?
Actually, there is a pretty significant commitment. He continues to fund the investments that he has initiated for Everglades funding. And he's started something new that is quite, this would be groundbreaking if the legislature approves it. And it is a program called Resilient Florida. It basically would give $1 billion over 4 years in the form of grants to state and to local governments so that they could use it to address the effects of climate change, like sea level rise, intensified storms, shoring up areas that are impacted frequently by flooding. Now, the governor didn't use the word climate change when he announced this, but it's a bonding program. It's we've got, low interest rates. It's a good time for the state to go into bonding. And if this happens, it would be the largest investment in climate change related infrastructure than we've ever seen.
As you said, this budget is just a proposal by the governor, and it has to be voted on by the legislature. And of course, the legislature is controlled by Republicans. But as we've seen in the past, because that's been the case for a while, that doesn't always bode well for the governor. But what do you foresee happening? Do you think that the House and Senate are on board with the governor this time, or do you think there's going to be some tension there?
Well, I have to say, I've been a little surprised at the initial reaction from the legislature. So they have not been embracing his budget with open arms. This week we're going to hear the governor's, Chris Spencer, the governor's budget director, is appearing before legislative committees. And this morning was the first meeting, and they gave him some pretty rigorous questions and raised some doubts about some of their numbers. That, I have to admit, surprised me a little bit, because it looked as though this Republican-led legislature was kind of all on board. But this is why checks and balance system works. They should be asking questions. And the end result will be better for everybody if they do. The bottom line is, this governor's budget is just a recommendation. It's not going to pass in its entirety. He's highlighted what his top priorities are. and he'll have to fight for those to get them through. But the legislature ultimately has the final say.
Yeah. And of course, the way he would fight is with his veto pen at the end. March 2nd is the start of the session. Do you foresee COVID really dominating, you know, the conversation, or what are some of the other big things that we're going to be hearing a lot about during the session?
Well, you know, COVID should be dominating this session. There should be oversight about how the state has handled and managed a vaccine distribution program. But I have to say, just where I said checks and balances are good for things like the budget, they're also really important for things like a pandemic. And we have not seen that, and we are not likely to see that. This legislature is doing almost nothing to challenge the governor's decision-making on the execution of his healthcare-related decisions regarding the pandemic and COVID. The only thing COVID-related that we are watching is that they have moved legislation very quickly that would give liability protection to businesses that are sued because of negligence as it relates to the spread of COVID. So that is where their focus on COVID is. And I think that is something that is worth more scrutiny and more discussion, because the legislature is just not asking questions. The governor's office has an enormous amount of influence over who gets the vaccine, where and when. And it's all a big black box. There's nobody is asking questions about it, and except the media, and nobody knows how they're making those decisions.
And of course, now, you know, he doesn't have the same ally in the White House that he did before, and that we've seen actually now it's become quite adversarial. Let me ask about this, moving over to something that DeSantis is pressing hard on, is a bill that encompasses a lot of different things, but basically it's looking at protests. And this goes back to the Black Lives Matter protests from last summer. And he wants to push to really tighten the rules and the punishments for people protesting. Just remind us briefly again what he wants to see.
Well, essentially what this would do is strengthen the existing penalties for violations that spring out of a gathering in a protest of sorts. So if right now, you know, there's vandalism penalties and laws against that. If you do it in the process of a violent protest, the sanctions and the crime would increase. So it's designed to have more of a chilling effect on the kinds of violent protests that erupt as a result of these gatherings. And it does appear to be something that the governor thought of after Black Lives Matter protests around the state. And mostly what happened, I mean, there was not as much violence in Florida at all as there was in many other places.
Right.
So he seized the moment to pass a law in Florida that would tighten the grip on those.
And that is one of the things that we'll be looking at in the coming weeks as we prepare for the upcoming legislative session. Mary Ellen Kloss, again, Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Well, still to come, why aren't there more black nutritionists, and how is that affecting the health of minorities? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Black Lives Matter protests brought wider attention to the inequalities and injustices black people face. And that's not just within the justice system. It's also true within healthcare. More than 80% of nutritionists and dietitians are white. And this lack of diversity and the bias that comes with it can have a negative impact on the health of people of color. Dr. Marcia Magnus is an associate professor in the Department of Dietetics and Nutrition at Florida International University. And she recently published a book about culturally sensitive nutrition counseling. and she joins us now. Dr. Magnus, thank you so much for the time.
Oh, my pleasure, Louis. My pleasure.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Nzinga Oniwasan. She's an holistic health consultant and the founder of the wellness website, Yes, Baby, I Like It Raw, as in raw food. Nzinga, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I wanted to hear about, from both of you, how you got into this field in the first place. Nzinga, let me start with you. From my understanding is you had health issues, right? And that's kind of what led you down this path.
Yes, definitely was the catalyst for my personal journey. I would say it started with me suffering from childhood obesity. At the age of 11, I was wearing size 18 in children's, which is pretty hard to find at that time. My mom had to order clothes from JCPenney catalog. And then very shortly after, I was being diagnosed as pre-hypertensive. And right after that, I was actually then diagnosed with a benign brain tumor, polycystic ovary syndrome, and an autoimmune disorder called scleroderma. And so that was all diagnosed by the time I was 14. And I was essentially told that I would have to be on medication for the rest of my life in order to thrive. Fast forward my sophomore year in college, I decided to do a little bit more unpacking of what I was told. And I felt like diet could play a major role in me reversing some of the symptoms from the things I was diagnosed with. And I'm here to say 20 years later, I no longer need to use medication. I'm definitely not obese. And I've been able to thrive despite the diagnosis that I had.
And just to be clear, that was your sophomore year of college. Were you on medication up to that point?
Yes, I was. So okay. Up until that point, I had been placed on medication for over a decade. And so that transition was a bit difficult because my body had become used to it. But with my primary care physician and some holistic practitioners, I was able to wean myself off of that medication. Mm.
Dr. Magnus, what about you? What brought you down this path?
Well, you know, Louis, it became very easy for me to write the book because I had published, you know, more than 50 articles that were somehow related to culturally sensitive nutrition services. But the real driver was all of the Jamaicans who live here, who I know, if they would tell me that they were going to see a dietitian, I would say to them, "So how was it?" And I would say, "No big thing." And I would, of course, probe. I mean, I teach students to become dietitians. And the general impression was, I'll tell you the Jamaican version of this, and then I'll translate it into English.
Okay.
Their response usually was, "She don't know nothing about Jamaican foods." Translation. "She does not know anything about Jamaican foods and which Jamaican foods I can use to reverse my hypertension." So it was clear. Our clients today in this town and in every other town that has 2 million people in this country, yeah, do not look like, shop like, eat like the people who are counseling them.
Yeah, right. No.
And that's a problem.
So your book is called Culturally Sensitive Nutrition Counseling. And I'm wondering, what are the biases and the misconceptions that you've seen from the nutrition field? And you started talking about that just now. Because they don't look like they're, you know, a lot of their patients, especially down here in South Florida. And that becomes a problem.
Well, look, you know, the problem, there are multiple problems. Let's just take name alone. And Nzinga was just introduced. Now, if you see somebody's name as Nzinga, who is an African queen, clearly, did this child live in the United States for how long? Parents are they American? Where are they? So one of the big assumptions that many dietitians and nutritionists make is that, can I really ask about her name? Can I ask about the hijab? Is that going to be offensive? If they have an accent, should I even mention it? And yeah, I'm here to say, yes. because that accent determines what they eat. That hijab tells you that they might be eating a whole lot of Middle Eastern foods. So right. that bias alone, that big question, I can't ask about it because it might be offensive.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know what, and Singa, I was curious when you first started looking into, you know, other options for your health and beyond just medication, did you run into that issue, running into healthcare professionals who they didn't look like you and they didn't understand your background, and were they asking the right questions? Did you go down that path?
Great question. No one on my team looked like me. Every physician I was working with was a white male, down to my gynecologist, although I will say I liked him. But in my journey, I was actually informed at one point that by one particular doctor, and I don't think she had the best, this was a doctor I later had right before I transitioned, who told me essentially that there was nothing she could do for me because I was a black person. And that was just kind of...
Wait. She said she couldn't do anything for you because you're black?
I quote. And I had to just deal with what I was dealing with in regards to some of the symptoms that I was experiencing from my autoimmune disorder. And so I'll just see how you were taken aback. Imagine I'm paying to see this person, and that was the response I got as I'm trying to negotiate and navigate finding some sense of wellness. So sometimes it's not just like bias in the background. Sometimes that kind of thing actually comes in the room with the physician, where they're like, well, because you're black, there's not too much that we can do.
Oh my, I just never heard that. I'm trying to imagine if somebody had come up to me and said, I can't help you. You're a Latino. I can't help you. You're a man. I don't know how to help you. Maybe I just can't understand that. Dr. Magnus, have you ever heard that? I mean,
this is wonderful. When a healthcare provider tells you that, I think that is an absolute blessing. What they're saying is they're not capable of treating you. Exit now.
Get away from that person. Go find a better doctor.
Absolutely. In fact, it's the reverse. It's when a healthcare practitioner, and this runs the whole gamut, when they pretend that they are capable of treating you, when they're in fact not capable because they literally cannot see beyond your skin color. If you're ever on a natural high, and Zynga, you probably know of this, and you need to come down slowly, one of the most painful books you could ever read is called Medical Apartheid. And it chronicles the last 300 years of the destruction of health by healthcare providers. Openly.
Yeah. That is a conversation that we probably should be having at some point in the future. Dr. Magnus, I wanted to ask you about some part of the work that you did. I'm not sure if it was also part of the book, but just some research you did, trying to help, you know, men. And you went to local barbershops to have conversations about nutrition. And it's a fascinating conversation. Anybody who's been in a barbershop, you know that atmosphere. But tell me about why you had that idea and what was that like for you?
Well, I'm from Jamaica. And Jamaican men, unfortunately, have the highest prostate cancer mortality rate in the world. Let me tell you. Mm-hmm. And so when I got here in 1991, there's a half a million Caribbean people, and the majority of them are Jamaicans. And these men have a prostate cancer mortality rate. Black men in general in the United States have a prostate cancer mortality rate that is 2.5 times that of white men. So it was clear to me that the need was ever present. And then I said, okay, where am I going to find these black men? And the only place that I could find some black men who were not under the influence of mood-modifying substances that we could do some nutrition education, mm-hmm, was in a barbershop. So I said, I have a by you. So why don't I just go to them?
So when you approach these men to talk about their health, and you want to tell them, look, a big part of your health is what you're eating, were they open to having that conversation? Did they want to talk to you about that?
Well, no. And it took me about 2 years to figure out that nutrition was going to have to come in through the back door. We would start to talk about nutrition and how it could reverse your blood pressure. I got some yawns. How it could make you lose weight? More yawns. How it could get your blood cholesterol to go down? More and more yawns. And then I hit the jackpot. I said, how nutrition can power up your prostate.
And okay, then they finally listened. They finally listened.
Oh, right there.
Ah, okay.
So all of a sudden, the hypertension and that was irrelevant. And the good news is that the foods that you're going to need to eat to keep your prostate happy are very much like the foods that you're going to need to eat to keep your blood pressure happy and to keep your blood cholesterol happy and to keep your weight where it needs to be. So, you know, you have to work with what Thurgood Marshall said. I did the best I could with what I had.
Usually you can find something to, if you have to reach men on a level, you can always find something and they'll start to listen to you. And Zinga, I'm curious, you work with people to help them with their health through nutrition and diet, also through yoga and other means. Typically, who's your customer? Who's coming to you?
I have a range of clients, but mainly it's women of color, so not just Black women of Hispanic descent, and men above the age of 30. That's when a lot of those health conditions start to check in, and they want a different way. I think most of my clients hear my story, and that becomes a stepping board for them to connect with me because they know I've been on the journey, and sometimes that makes me more relatable because I know what it feels like to be on the other side where you're dealing with a health crisis and you want to find a way to thrive and be healthy.
And when you talk to your customers, I think about that doctor who said, I can't treat you, I can't help you. And I'm just wondering, like, when you deal with some of your customers, they come from different places. How much do you want to know about where they're coming from to help you in helping them?
I like to know how their doctor feels about working alongside with holistic practices. I would say that my primary care doctor, when I made the transition, really felt that my going vegan would really help me mitigate some of the symptoms I was dealing with. And so I don't want to have an antagonistic relationship with their physician where when I suggest something and for them to try it, their doctor is absolutely saying no to it. And so it's kind of like, let's work together as a team. And so that kind of gives me a sense of if this will work or will I be the bad guy in the narrative? And a lot of times that doesn't work in the long run.
Yeah. Again, I'm talking with Nzinga Aniwasan. She's a holistic health consultant and the founder of the wellness website, Yes Baby, I Like It Raw, as in raw food. Also talking with Dr. Marcia Magnus. She's an associate professor in the Department of Dietetics and Nutrition at Florida International University. And again, talking about how 87%, as we mentioned before, of nutritionists and dietitians tend to be white. They're white females. And how does that help all people, people of color, Black, brown? Because we come from different places. We have different diets, the ethnicity too. When you think about like our traditional diets from our home island, our home country, and how does that play a role? And Zinga, I want to start with you on this. You're also a chef. And I'm wondering, you know, some of our traditional dishes, you know, we bring from, I'm from Puerto Rico, half Colombian. You think about Mexican, Nicaraguan, et cetera. They're delicious, but they're not always the healthiest. So how about when you're dealing with your customers? Because you're a vegan. What do you tell them about keeping those traditions but making them healthier?
I tell them that they definitely can keep their traditional dishes. It's just making small tweaks to it. And I think that becomes more comforting than what they're often told by dietitians who don't know a different pathway, where they're told they have to give up all their cultural foods. And so it's just really learning how to make those meals healthier. And I think particularly in my area, when we're incorporating more plant-based foods, there's a stereotype that plant-based foods don't taste really well. So with my background as Haitian, I have had people who literally said, because you're Haitian, I know your food will taste good. And so I trust you to help me make healthier choices. So
let me, because you, again, as a vegan, I mean, this you know, this topic is going to be highly debated by people. It's like, what's better? Is it vegetarian? Is it vegan? And then you're going even further. You're talking about just raw foods, and that's another, you know, level of consumption. And so, how do you approach it? Is it you're trying to convince people of a certain lifestyle because this lifestyle saved your life? Or is it, you know what, I'm going to respect wherever they're at and just show them options?
I meet people where they're at. My goal for them is to eat more plants. I'm really focused on data, so I like to show them research. And so that becomes really important. And so how can we change and cultivate your traditional dishes so that they're going to help you thrive instead of throwing you into a space of disease? And how then can we incorporate more plants with every meal? And so I think that's why a lot of my clients love me and then suggest me to other people, because I'm not telling them to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, how can we add some flower petals in there and a little powdered almond milk in your bath so that it's more loving to you and your mind, body, and spirit.
Yeah. Dr. Magnus, I go back to that. I wonder, when you're sitting in those barbershops talking to men, how do you convince them? Like, you can still enjoy, and look, the foods we grow up with, food is so important. It's, you know, I think about the food my mom made, my grandmother made, and, there's emotion attached to it. And I love it. I love the way it tastes. I don't want to give it up, but I know that I should be eating healthier. How did you have those conversations with those men about how they can keep traditions but eat healthier?
Well, there are a number of strategies that you have to use. The first one is what Nzinga is using, which is the testimonials. See, part of the problem is that most people do not know a person who has reversed any condition. They don't know Nzinga. They don't know Les Brown, who's PSA. That's a protein that gives you an idea of how inflamed your prostate is. It's supposed to be 5, no more than 5. His PSA was 2,000. They couldn't believe he was alive. And
oh, my
his
God.
PSA today is of a brand new baby. If you don't know anybody who can say, oh, I used to have diabetes, or, oh, I don't use insulin anymore. So that's the first step. If you don't have a testimonial to share, you don't stand a chance in a barbershop.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Cornell, and what I learned in Cornell was about the nutrients. Yes, sir, I got those nutrients down. And then I discovered, oh, that's about half the story. I need to get into the nutrition world that you live in.
And you,
because your nutrition world, you know, there are people who believe that illness is caused by fate, that it runs in your family. Evil spirit came and took the baby. If I don't stop to find out what you believe about health, how can I help you to tackle that?
Yeah. And by the way, you do more than just talk about what to eat. You also talk about how to eat it. And that's important.
Absolutely. So my great discovery in the barbershop university was that people are eating on autopilot. I mean, we're doing most things on autopilot right
now. Yes.
But the strategy that has worked amazingly well is take the food that you love. There is a food that you are not going to give up. What is that food for you, Louis? Tell me. And you know it's not good for you.
Oh, food that I don't want to give up. Okay, well, you know what? Listen, I enjoy, I hate to admit this, I enjoy donuts.
Donuts. Very good. So to do, Louis, believe it or not, is to fall in love with donuts.
Okay.
And you are going to take charge of this relationship that you have with donuts. You're not going to let the donuts commercial determine what you eat. And you're going to decide, I have a responsibility to my body. I'm supposed to be eating 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day.
Yes.
And when I say vegetables, I don't mean potatoes, corn, or yucca. I mean something that's green, cabbage, and sprout. Right?
Yes.
So you're going to have to cut a deal with your body.
Yeah.
My boys in the barbershop understand cut a deal. Right?
That's okay.
Have you had your 5 servings of fruits and vegetables today?
Not yet, but I'm working on it.
Say again?
Not yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay. If the answer to that question is yes, then it's donut time.
Okay, good.
And you're going to sit down with this donut. You're going to close your eyes. You need a cup of water or a glass of water. After every sip of the donut, when you close your eyes, you can't watch TV, you can't use your phone. Remember, we're falling in love with the donut.
Okay.
You're going to chew it. You're going to say, this is the best donut in the world. It's going to take you so long to eat this donut, and you're going to enjoy it so much. Why? Because you earned it.
Good point. I like that. No, that's actually a very good point. I had to stop there only because of time. But I see what you're saying. Don't just consume, especially the way we tend to consume, which is very quickly, not thinking about what we're eating. Take the time to actually think about what it is you're eating, and with a lot more purpose. That's a very good point.
There's a whole term for it. It's called mindful eating.
Very good.
Where the texture and the color and the taste and the flavor, you're just having a party in your mouth.
I know. You know what? And Zig, I'm going to just get you in real quickly. I just wanted to get a sense from you. What has to change? Or, you know, how do we change things so that we have more people who look like their patients?
I think there's so many things that need to change. We need to let people who look like myself know that being a dietitian or nutritionist is a viable career and what it is. I think a lot of times in our community, we're really big on nurse, doctor, lawyer, you know. And so we a lot of times people don't go into the field because they don't know about it.
Yeah.
We need more dietitians and nutritionists to be public like we have right now in this conversation we're having through the radio. And we need more testimonials.
Yes.
And I think also we also need to train the dietitians who aren't familiar with those cultural nuances so that they can be more culturally sensitive. And we also need to address the elephant in the room, which is the schools that they're coming from are not creating culturally sensitive dietitians
right.
and nutritionists.
Oh.
And that's the bigger issue, right?
So many more things. Yeah, we're not doing. That's true. I have to end it there only because of time, but this is a fun conversation. And now I feel guilty. I'm going to go have a salad after this. And Zinga Oniwasan, I want to thank her, a holistic health consultant, founder of the wellness website. Yes, baby, I like it raw. Raw foods. Check it out. Also, Dr. Marcia Magnus, associate professor in the Department of Dietetics and Nutrition at Florida International University. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Enjoy your fruits and vegetables.
I will. I promise. Thank you both. All right. Still to come. Miami was not always the art destination that it is. How did it become one? Let's find out. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, Miami has become an international destination for art lovers, with a diverse array of art institutions, collectors, and creators keeping the scene vibrant. But this did not happen overnight. Nearly 2 decades ago, Miami Beach hosted its first Art Basel. And over the past decade, it's seen the International Art Fair explode into an entire art week. Neighborhoods like Wynwood, Coconut Grove, and Alapan have become artistic melting pots. Here to discuss this history and the future for Miami's art scene is Barry Fellman. He's the photographer behind the new book, Miami Creative, A Decade of Transformation. Barry, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Lewis.
You know, I was looking through this book and, you know, I was thinking about some of the stuff I've had the chance to see, but I mean, this is spanning over the last decade. I'd imagine that you collected tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pictures. Tell me about, like, when did you decide I could put some of this together in a book?
Oh, gosh. You know, you're the first person that has asked me about the process and has clued into the fact that there must have been a lot of pictures.
So, oh, I've known plenty of photographers. Oh, yes.
And
so I'd imagine. Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe around 15 years ago or something, I made a New Year's resolution. I'd better take my camera with me everywhere. That was the time when cameras are getting a little more digital and smaller and good enough to take a decent picture. And so I said, there's no excuse not to take it. So that's how that started. And then I've been going ever since. And I thought, we're coming on, you know, a big decade. Let me try to put something together. So you're right. I've been doing it for a while, tens of thousands of pictures, if not more. And I thought, this is the time to do it. We've hit a tipping point, and it happened during the last decade, a transformation, I think, like no other metropolitan area worldwide has seen in such a short time. The city was just transformed by culture and art.
Yeah. And you, I mean, look, you've been here, you've seen from the beginning, you've seen this transformation. Miami was not this at all before. And then all of a sudden, art started coming in. But just from your perspective, how did that happen? How did it go from that, you know, we knew it as the cocaine cowboy capital, and it was actually at one point considered the most dangerous city in America, to now this haven for artists?
Yeah, that's certainly right. We've been on the top of many lists. Yes. Money laundering, cocaine capital, COVID capital for a while here. And now we really are on the top of the art capital list. And it's transformed how the international world has really seen Miami. And it has brought an incredibly more diverse population and a lot of money to the city over the last decade.
And you know what, though, going back to when it first started, like, you know, what were people saying when somebody comes up with the idea and say, let's bring more art to the city, considering where the city was at the time? Did everybody buy into that? Like, yeah, we can turn into a great place for art.
I think it happened slowly and organically, which is the amazing thing about our city, is things kind of happen underneath. They bubble around for quite a while. And the arts community here in Miami, believe it or not, was very deep and cohesive. Even decades ago, I was born here, and we had the Metropolitan Museum and Art Center. We had that beautiful installation of galleries at the Biltmore Hotel for a while. Mm-hmm. And the artists have always kind of done their thing, but somehow public perception about what was going on increased. And once public perception started to increase, and a couple of other things, Art Basel came, and the New Yorkers who had been coming here all along started to tell their friends, hey, you got to check out this thing happening or this artist who's in Miami. Those things came together perhaps a couple of decades ago, or even 30 or 40 years ago. We had that base. So we built organically from that base. It just turns out that in the last decade, things exploded. And I think it was in part due to Instagram and Art Basel.
You know, and I don't know if it's a fair question to ask you, but I think about the last 10 years. Can you say there's one thing that really, really put Miami on the map as an art destination? Was it like the Wynwood Walls? Was it the PAM? Was it Art Basel? What is there one thing that really did it?
I think you hit it on the head. It was a combination of several major things. Fantastic new structures of architectural renown in Museum Park, that great building that Herzog de Meuron did for the museum. And then that fabulous science museum with a 500,000 gallon aquarium. And then you have Art Basel coming in, and all the things that you've just mentioned really came together kind of as a tipping point, and they built on each other. So I don't think there was any one, but certainly some majors, like you pointed out.
Yeah. I think about, you know, when I moved here to Miami, so growing up in South Florida, I grew up in West Palm Beach, but you always had this vision of Miami and it was just another world, right? And so I moved around the country, and then the opportunity comes to come back to Miami, I'm like, I already know Miami. And people are telling me, no, it's changed. It's not the same place. I get here and yeah, I was amazed. One of the things that jumped out at me, for example, is like the PAM. And I think that a city has to have, you know, one of those really big, you know, art, one of those big places for art internationally to really have that kind of reputation, right? The PAM had to be there for Miami to have it more than Art Basel. Or you tell me, what do you think about that?
I think you're totally right. But I think it's just tough to point your finger at one thing. PAM's structure is just fabulous in how they integrated the out with the inside and how you can stand at PAM and then look over at the Science Museum through the gallery. So yeah, a lot of light, a lot of windows, yet still respectful of the preservation that's needed for displaying art. And I love their programming because they've been starting to invite other types of arts groups to be part of their realm. And for instance, Juggernaut Theater, there's a great picture, I think great, I shouldn't judge myself, but a fun picture in the book where they did kind of a pop-up Miami Stories within the museum. And people didn't know what was going on. And this is what's great about the arts community. It's fresh, it's exciting. And I think that's what I'm trying to tell in the pictures of the book. It's just a vibrant place with so many things going on, with weird Miami bus tours and outdoor installations that change the urban fabric, like Biscayne Green, where artists were invited to change two blocks of Biscayne Boulevard into something more pedestrian and user-friendly.
Yeah,
we're just all full of surprises and ways that the community can connect because of the arts and culture. And I think this is what's incredible about the city, and what I'm trying to show in the book is that arts and culture has the capability to be transformative to the way we live and to the way we experience life. And it actually has transformed a major urban center like Miami.
Yeah. Again, I'm talking with Barry Fellman. He's the editor of the new book of art. It's called Miami Creative, A Decade of Transformation. We posted some of the photos, by the way, on our Facebook page at WLRN Sundial. Beautiful book, a beautiful collection of photos that he's been collecting, you know, for the past decade.
I must say, Lewis, they're my photos. I'm the photographer.
Right. No, exactly. His photos, as I mentioned at the beginning, he must have collected so many because there are a lot to pick from. I wanted to get to one thing, you know, going back to the Perez Art Museum. We were there not too long ago when they had the Christos Famous Surrounded Islands exhibit. And this goes back many, many years. But that was a fascinating conversation. Let's go back to a little bit of that.
And I remember vividly that one elderly lady came to Jean-Claude and say, I like to talk to people who is responsible. Jean-Claude, I'm responsible. Yeah. Madame, this is the most awful things I see in my life. Terrible. It looks like a giant Pepto-Bismol pill. Jean-Claude, okay, he thinks like that. After that, a few days later, all the gentlemen came in and said to Jean-Claude, I have to see them. Who is responsible? Yeah, I am responsible. That old man, Madame, I cannot believe it. This is marvelous things. I never see something so beautiful in my life. You look like the giant Pepto-Bismol spill.
So that's Cristo, the famous artist. And of course, that was the Surrounded Islands, when he surrounded some of the islands in pink. That's why he says Pepto-Bismol. Why do you believe that art piece remains such an iconic artistic moment in our history?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that, I think, was the moment that there was this glimmer and there was an explosion after the glimmer that, hey, Miami does have an arts community. If you were here at that time, it was super exciting and everyone participated in it, not only from the arts community, but from the community wide, from every sector, from tourism and hotels to universities. And this really gave the world an idea that, yes, there is a deep and connected arts community in Miami.
Yeah.
And so that might have been the real beginning.
You know, the pandemic obviously has taken its toll. Not as many people going into museums and galleries. We lost Art Basel this past year, but we'll get through it. But for you, a person who's been here all these years and you've seen the transformation briefly, tell me, what do you hope to see in the next 10 years?
Wow, that's such a great question. I know that the shift to digital will continue to inform how we experience life. And I'm really looking forward to how creative minds, which are artist by nature, take this new shift and make it possible for more people to experience the art that we have and the art that's in other places through digital means, and how that can be integrated with a physical experience. That to me is really exciting. I know there are very many types of virtual worlds that even go back to Second Life. And yeah. And I think we've just nipped at the surface of how digital and physical are going to help inform what we see, what we do, and what we love.
Well, Barry, prepare yourself to collect thousands and thousands of more photographs over the next decade so we can talk about that next book. But the book now that he is the editor and the photographer of, it is Miami Creative, A Decade of Transformation. Barry, it's such a pleasure. Beautiful book. Absolutely loved it.
Lewis, thank you so much for having me. I do want to give a shout out to Frank Casal, who is the editor and really did the job of helping me pick what was in the book. And if you want more information about the book, miamicreative.org.
All right. Barry, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And that is our program for this Tuesday, February 2nd. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Stay safe. We'll be back again live tomorrow.